routine STI screening. HIV. The acronym HIV stands for Human Immunodeficiency Virus. For a lot of people, especially if, like us, you came of age in the 1980s, it is a STI that triggers the greatest fear. It is also one you're very unlikely to encounter, at least if you live in North America, and unless you're a gay or bi man. Nearly half of all HIV cases are in men who have sex with men. HIV is a virus that attacks the human immune system. It is the cause of the disease known as AIDS, which stands for Acquired Immune Deficiency Syndrome. AIDS can kill you, as can many common infections if your immune system is compromised by AIDS. There is no cure for HIV or AIDS, but today there are highly effective treatments, for those who can afford them, to hold it in check. A diagnosis of HIV was once considered a death sentence. But this is no longer the case. Many people with HIV now live out normal lifespans, with few or no symptoms, though with a heavy drug regime. And many have lived for years with no detectable viral load. HIV can be transmitted in body fluids, including blood, semen, vaginal fluid, and breast milk. In addition to sex, it can be transmitted by hypodermic needles, blood transfusions, pregnancy, or breastfeeding. HIV enters the body either directly through the bloodstream, such as with infected needles, or through mucous membranes. Anal sex is substantially riskier than vaginal sex for HIV transmission, and being the receptive partner is riskier than being the penetrative partner. Risk of transmission through oral sex, whether giving or receiving, is extremely low. Condoms are highly effective at preventing HIV transmission. HIV is detected through a blood test or an oral swab test. Testing is more or less the only way to know whether you have it. Most people with HIV have no symptoms for years before developing AIDS. Hepatitis. Paradoxically, most people don't think of hepatitis as an STI, yet it is one of the more common and also more dangerous ones. The word hepatitis broadly refers to any infection of the liver, but usually people are speaking of hepatitis A, B, or C, which are caused by viruses. Hepatitis A is transmitted by consuming infected fecal particles, such as through eating contaminated food, or rarely through oral sex. Hepatitis B can be transmitted sexually, and both hepatitis B and C can be transmitted through blood. Hepatitis C is not generally considered an STI. All three strains of hepatitis are diagnosed through a blood test. Many STI clinics do test for hepatitis B as a matter of course now, but many still do not. Most cases of hepatitis A or B in higher income countries where people have adequate access to rest, nutrition, and clean water will resolve on their own. Antiviral treatments are sometimes used for hepatitis B. In some cases, though, about 5% of infected adults, hepatitis B can become chronic, often leading to cirrhosis and liver failure. By far, the best protection against hepatitis is vaccination. Safe and effective vaccines exist for both hepatitis A and B, and they're covered under many insurance policies. If your family doctor doesn't have it, or you don't have a family doctor, travel medicine clinics, which specialize in preventative medicine for people traveling abroad, are an easy place to get vaccinated. Now to the common but less serious infections. HSV. Herpes. HSV, or herpes simplex virus, is one of the two most common sexually transmitted infections. There are several variants or strains of herpes. The two we usually associate with the name herpes are herpes 1 and herpes 2, which cause skin lesions that can appear on the face or eyes, around the genitals, or on other parts of the body. Chickenpox is caused by a different strain of the herpes virus, called herpes varicella zoster virus, or herpes 3, which also causes shingles. Mononucleosis is a variant of herpes called herpes Epstein-Barr, EBV, or herpes 4. There are other variants of herpes as well, including cytomegalovirus, herpes 5, and a pair of herpes viruses that cause a common childhood disease called Rosola, herpes 6 and 7, and a very rare variant usually only found in immunocompromised people that leads to a type of cancer called Kaposi's sarcoma, herpes 8. Most people think herpes 1 causes cold sores and herpes 2 causes genital herpes, but this isn't accurate. Either strain can affect any part of the body. They're incredibly common. A According to a recent study, well over half of adults in North America have HSV-1, and one in six North Americans have HSV-2. Most people who have herpes are not aware that they do. Another study showed that of people in North America who are seropositive for herpes, less than 20% are aware they have it. As mentioned earlier, that means that up to half of all North Americans carry herpes but think they don't. Part of the reason so few people who have herpes know it is that for the most people, herpes may cause one outbreak and then remain dormant for years or decades. Many people acquire it as a child. Outbreaks, especially of genital herpes, are often so mild they aren't recognized for what they are. The shame and stigma associated with herpes are far worse than the infection itself. This is particularly ironic when we consider that statistically, many of the people who loudly proclaim they would never date anyone with herpes actually have herpes and don't know it. If you've never been specifically tested for herpes, don't assume you don't have it, and don't freak out if a partner or potential partner tells you he does. Don't assume you've been tested for it just because you've had an STI screening. Most clinics don't test for herpes unless you specifically ask them to, and even then a lot of clinics resist testing for it because it's so common and usually so minor and the stigma is so great. There's an idea that having sex with a partner who has herpes is a sure ticket to contracting it yourself, but this is not true. There is no surefire way to guarantee protection, but barriers, antiviral drugs, lysine supplements, and even stress reduction all reduce the risk of transmission. Herpes is very often spread non-sexually. Any skin-to-skin contact, including secondary contact, can potentially spread the virus. Many people contract HSV-1 as children through non-sexual contact with other people who have it. Athletes can spread HSV through skin contact. Any athlete who engages in contact sports can develop herpes Whitlow, a skin infection caused by HSV-1 or HSV-2. In other words, you can't assume you don't have herpes if you haven't been tested for it. You can't assume you're guaranteed to get it if your partner has it. And you can't assume you won't get it if you never have a partner who has it. The fear is radically disproportionate to the risk. There's one exception: during childbirth. Herpes can be passed to the newborn and have serious effects. An expectant mother having an active herpes outbreak may need a cesarean birth. Herpes is the most transmissible during an active outbreak that causes an open sore. Outbreaks can be prevented or controlled by antivirals such as Acyclovir. As we write this book, a vaccine against herpes is entering early clinical trials. Should it prove to be successful, such a vaccine could be on the market within the next decade. This has the potential to drastically alter the landscape of herpes infections. Until such a vaccine is available, the best defense against herpes is knowledge. We believe that many people are unnecessarily stigmatized by herpes, and that we all engage in activities every day that are far more risky than having a partner who has HSV. HPV. HPV, or human papillomavirus, is the STI you are most likely to encounter. In fact, as many as 80% of people will be exposed to HPV over the course of their lives, and anywhere between 10 and 40% of people have an active infection right now, with the highest rates of active infection found in people under 25. HPV is the virus associated with cervical cancer and genital warts, and is now being linked to throat and rectal cancer as well. About 1 in 150 women will develop cervical cancer over their lifetimes, and 1 in 435 will die from it. As scary as this may sound, this is a significantly lower risk than other kinds of cancer, such as breast cancer, which claims 10 times as many lives. And cervical cancer and its precursor condition are very curable if caught early by regular checkups and pap tests. Contrary to what many people believe, there is no reliable test for HPV because it can infect many areas and the infection is localized. False negatives are common. If you're a woman and you've ever had an abnormal pap smear, you have probably been exposed to HPV. You can be infected with HPV in the rectum and throat, as well as parts of the genital area besides the cervix. Most people's bodies clear an HPV infection within 1 to 2 years. During that time, they can be infectious, but usually not after. Some infections, though, linger. These can cause cancer and infect others years after exposure. Many people believe that since nearly everyone has been or will be exposed to HPV in their lifetimes, there's no point trying to protect yourself. This is not precisely true. There are hundreds of strains of HPV, dozens of which can cause cancer. Even if you've already been infected with one strain, you can still be infected with another. And there's some evidence that co-infection with more than one strain raises your risk of cancer, though there's no scientific consensus on that point yet. Vaccines for HPV are available that protect against most prevalent strains, which together are responsible for 70% of cervical cancers and 90 to 95% of genital warts cases. Barriers, like condoms, offer some protection against HPV, but aren't recommended as a reliable risk reduction strategy. But between barriers and vaccination, you can actually get fairly decent protection. In addition, barriers disproportionately reduce the higher risk HPV infections, those that are more likely to lead to cervical cancer. You can also purchase latex shorts online. These are worth considering for HPV or HSV protection for casual encounters. And women get pap smears at the intervals recommended by your doctor. And make sure your doctor knows you have multiple sexual partners. Many doctors will say that the HPV vaccine is available only to women under the age of 26. This is untrue. Anyone of any gender or any age can get the vaccine. However, you will likely have to pay for it. At the time of writing, the vaccine costs about $150 per dose, and three doses are required over a six-month period. Not all doctors are aware that the vaccine can be given to people over 26. You may have to educate your doctor. In the United States, you can get the vaccine with little difficulty at Planned Parenthood. In Canada, travel medicine clinics are also happy to dispense it. The number one controllable risk factor for HPV is the number of sexual partners you have. To reduce their risk of exposure to HPV, as well as other STIs, some people choose to limit intercourse to just a few partners over their lives, while engaging in other non-penetrative sexual activities with other partners. HPV risk is another good reason to understand the sexual histories of the people you are considering having sex with. Even if they present test results for the usual suspects, which do not include HPV. The more sexual partners someone has, or has had, the more you may wish to limit the activities you do with them, or only have barriered sex. We'd be lying if we said there's nothing to be afraid of, or that there's no way to reduce your risk of contracting HPV, but at the same time, we see far too much judgment and fear of people who disclose that they are HPV positive. Most of us will, despite our best efforts, be exposed at least once in our lives, and most of us will never know it. HPV is ubiquitous, and people who have it should not be stigmatized. For some perspective, remember that most of the countless infectious diseases you are exposed to are not transmitted sexually. If you are not washing your hands when you come in from public places and using a tissue rather than a finger to clean your eyes and nose, it makes little sense to panic about STIs. In America, you have a 1 in 30 lifetime chance of dying from an infectious disease overall. Compare that to the numbers quoted above. At the same time, of course, death is not the only concern when thinking about STIs. Long-term effects such as sterility are possible. So educate yourself and make the most rational risk assessments you can, but don't live in fear. Questions to ask yourself. All sex carries risk. There's no way to eliminate those risks entirely, and it's quite difficult for human beings to rationally evaluate risk. The questions below are geared to helping you minimize your risk and determine the level of risk you feel okay with. Do I know my current STI status and that of all my partners, including HSV, confirmed by testing? How do I feel about me or my partner having sex with someone whose STI status is unknown? What do I consider safer sex under such circumstances? How do I feel about me or a partner having sex with someone who has a common STI such as HSV? What do I consider safer sex under such circumstances? 21. Polypuzzles. We can easily be hurt and broken, And it's good to remember that we can just as easily be the ones who have done the hurting and breaking. Desmond Tutu. Our experiences with polyamory have taken us nose to nose with some thorny difficulties, some of which we have not yet discovered a solution for. Those puzzles are the topic of this chapter. Some of these problems lack graceful answers. Others seem to lack answers at all. Should you run into one of these, the best advice we can offer is to try and keep focused on behaving as ethically as you can. Treat those around you with gentleness and seek to be the best version of yourself. Above all else, use love and compassion as your guiding stars. If you discover a solution to these problems, we'd love to hear from you. You may see yourself in some of the examples we give. That's okay. We're all still trying to carve trails through this terrain. And some of the dead ends and quagmires along the way look like tempting paths. Our purpose is not to chastise, but rather to alert you to hidden traps that might open unexpectedly beneath your feet. Entitlement creep. In any relationship, we can become so accustomed to a status quo that it slowly morphs into an entitlement. When this happens in polyamory, the disruption and resource reallocation that a new relationship brings can erupt into anger and conflict if an established partner feels something that is hers is being taken away. Entitlement to another's time is the most obvious sort of entitlement creep. Say you have two partners, Linda and Richard. Richard is a busy fellow. So for the past year, you've only been able to go on dates with him once a month. This lets you offer more time to Linda, who is used to seeing you three or four times a week. Then Richard's life changes, and he becomes more available to you. So now you see both Linda and Richard twice a week. Linda might naturally grieve the loss of the more connected relationship, but she may also have become so accustomed to it that she sees it as a promise that you will always spend the same amount of time with her. So when you begin paring back time with Linda, her feelings of sadness or loneliness may be mixed with betrayal or outrage. You've broken a promise you never offered. That's entitlement creep. We've heard this phrased as, he's not respecting my relationship, even if the new partner is still receiving less time than the existing one. Sometimes people do neglect their existing partners in the rush and glow of a new relationship, but neglect can be hard to define. New relationships will require division of resources from somewhere else. If not other relationships, then hobbies, work, or even time alone. Not just time, but also activities, support, and money can be subject to entitlement creep. Communicate explicitly about expectations, rather than assuming that nothing should ever change. As we talk about in Who Owns Your Time, it's important to recognize the agency of your partners and remember that their time and resources are always their own to give. This recognition helps clear the way to another part of the solution, which is gratitude. If you believe you are getting something by right, it's easy to take it for granted and not recognize its value. Remember that your partner is acting freely out of love for you and a desire to be with you. Be grateful for what they give, but understand that they do not owe you the same thing forever. Fatal cascades. When we are afraid of something, losing a partner, say, or being replaced, or not getting a job promotion we feel we deserve, we can act defensively, which can cause exactly the calamity we're trying to prevent. These actions can create cascading feedback loops that are often fatal to a relationship. Franklin created one of these self-fulfilling prophecies of doom in his relationship with Ruby, described in Chapter 8. He felt so threatened when she started dating Newton that he began to act defensively, criticizing her and withdrawing from her until she broke up with him. He was not originally in danger of being replaced, but his fear of being replaced caused him to destroy the relationship. When problems arise, look carefully to yourself. Are your actions making the problem worse? Are you blaming a partner for something she hasn't done yet, just because you're afraid she might? Are you actually pushing her toward doing what you don't want? What are the expectations between you? Have you communicated them clearly? Another version of a destructive feedback loop is what we call the deadly chain. It usually begins simply, perhaps with a compromise that ends up bargaining away something you need to be happy, or with a series of concessions that turn into entitlement creep. Or maybe you've given up some degree of bodily autonomy, like agreeing not to choose a certain type of partner or agreeing not to have certain kinds of sex with new lovers. So now you've agreed to something and you feel unhappy. Over time, your feelings drift from I'm unhappy that I made that choice to I'm unhappy to my partner is asking me to be unhappy to my partner is making me unhappy to I have the right to make my partner unhappy too. Now you're playing the tit-for-tat unhappiness game, where each of you considers your own comfort over the happiness of your partner's, descending the deadly chain toward its bitter end. You can avoid the deadly chain if you're willing to closely examine your priorities, especially as they relate to your happiness. What boundaries can you set to protect your actual needs? How important is your own autonomy? Are you communicating your boundaries and needs? If you have negotiated away something that turns out to be an essential part of your happiness, you always have the right to renegotiate to get it back. The Caucasian Chalk Circle. The Caucasian Chalk Circle is a play by Bertolt Brecht, based on the story of the Judgment of Solomon. It involves a young boy whose parentage is disputed. Two women claim to be his mother. To decide custody, the judge assigns a test. A circle is drawn on the ground in chalk, and the boy is placed in the middle. The two women stand on either side of the circle, and each take an arm. The judge says that whoever pulls the boy out of the circle gets him. If they pull him apart, they will get part. You can probably tell how this ends. One of the women refuses to pull hard enough. The judge declares her the true mother, because she is the one who refused to hurt the child. In poly relationships, there are overt cases where two or more partners try to pull a pivot person away from the other. The one who cares least about the damage being done to the relationship pulls hardest. And there are plenty of cases where a partner comes right out and says, "You have to choose between him and me." But the tug of war is often far subtler than that. Conflicts over scheduling or other commitments, or ongoing struggles with jealousy, or a desire to limit another relationship, or to create a relationship structure that makes the other relationships more difficult, can create chronic tension, with the pivot feeling pulled in two. There's no wise judge, of course, to decide who is the more worthy partner. Even following the metaphor of the chalk circle, that the partner who is pulling the least is the more worthy, isn't always the best decision. A partner who's demanding that you make a choice might be engaged in invalid boundary setting. I can no longer remain in a relationship with you if you continue your relationship with Ellen. If you're one of the people pulling and you see your partner in pain, it may seem obvious that the thing to do is stop pulling. But that's often harder than it seems. When you see someone else pulling on the other side, it can be terrifying just to let go. Because if you do, they'll just go flying out of the circle and into the arms of the other partner, right? Of course, in poly relationships, the person in the circle is not a helpless child. She is an adult with agency, capable of making her own choices. To trust enough to stop pulling is to trust your partner to make choices to be with you and to nurture your relationship of her own volition. And for the person in the circle, the best survival strategy is firm, clear boundary setting, such as, "I need you to stop pulling on me," repeated as often as necessary. Make clear and specific commitments about allocating your time, attention, and other resources, and then stick to them. See also Ping Pong Polly. One possible coping strategy comes from the original story of the Judgment of Solomon, a solution known as splitting the baby. In the Judgment of Solomon, the setup is similar. Two putative mothers arguing over custody of a child. Solomon commands that the baby be cut in two, with each woman to receive half each. One woman proclaims, "It shall be neither mine nor yours. Divide it." The other woman begs Solomon to spare the child, even if it means giving it to the other woman. Solomon, of course, awards custody to the second woman. In legal parlance, splitting the baby has come to refer to splitting the difference in negotiations. In the poly version of this story, splitting the baby might be a zero-sum relationship, discussed in Chapter 16. Mismatch desire. One of the advantages of polyamory we've talked about is not being dependent on one person to meet your sexual needs. In monogamous relationships, mismatched sexual desire is very common and can become an enormous source of stress. In polyamorous relationships, there's at least the option for a person with a high libido to seek multiple lovers and for the other to have some guilt-free peace. However, mismatched sexual desire still creates problems in polyamory. Sexual desire is not always general. Sometimes a person is drawn to one particular other more than the desire is reciprocated. This can create just as much tension in poly relationships as in monogamous ones. There's no easy solution. All healthy sexual relationships are consensual. We don't believe it's reasonable to expect someone to have sex more often than he wants to. Feelings of guilt or pressure around sex breed resentment, and resentment tends to depress sexual desire even more, creating a self-reinforcing cycle. Sexual desire isn't necessarily something that can be summoned with a snap of the fingers. If your partner desires you more than you desire him, that doesn't mean there's something wrong with either of you or the relationship. It happens. Gentleness with yourself and each other is likely to be much better for your relationship than guilt or blame. Some positive steps may help rekindle desire, taking time to be in touch with yourself and your partner without distractions or outside stressors can help set the mood. Spending time touching without expectation of sex or orgasm at the end can also help. Some couples are happy to grow close by one masturbating while the other cuddles and squeezes. Laurie B. Mintz's book, A Tired Woman's Guide to Passionate Sex, has been found in a peer-reviewed study to help improve sexual connection in long-term relationships. But sometimes the only thing that can be done about mismatched desire is to accept that it is what it is, and that a relationship is more than exchange of sexual gratification. Bar raisers. Bar raisers are specific kinds of game changer, and they may just be the scariest monster hiding under the poly bed. No one wants to talk about them. Yet many, if not all, of the rules and structures imposed on new relationships are designed, at least in part, to protect against them. But they happen. They hurt a lot. And like all game changers, they can't be prevented. Poly people like to say that one of the advantages of polyamory is we don't have to give up an existing relationship when someone new comes along. That's true. But sometimes we meet a new person who highlights the flaws in an existing relationship and teaches us there's a truly better way to live. Or maybe your existing relationship was just fine, but the new partner may show you new things, make you happier, help you realize that you can have something you never thought possible, help you to see the world in a different light. They may lead you to want more, or they may help you to be more. After that, you can't quite go home again. Sometimes a bar raiser can change what we want from all our relationships, or change what we look for in a partner. Sometimes they end up making our other relationships better, though often not until after a fair amount of strife. Sometimes we may decide that other relationships should end. Bar raisers show us that things we have taken for granted aren't necessarily true. In doing that, they show us paths to happiness we didn't know existed. Suddenly, things we had always accepted don't look so acceptable anymore. Here is Franklin's story.
My relationship with Amber was a bar raiser. Many of the compromises I had taken for granted as part of polyamory, giving up the freedom to choose my own partners, always having to keep others subordinate to my relationship with Celeste, became too painful to bear with Amber. But more than that, Amber showed me that a different approach was possible. I could have poly relationships without these compromises. I have also been on the other side of this process. When I started dating my partner Vera, she had three other relationships. Two of those met some, but not all, of her relationship needs. Each offered something she wanted, but with strings and conditions. One was hierarchical, with Vera as a secondary partner, and the other was a good sexual fit, but not a good partner fit. Her relationship with me threw the problems into sharp relief, altering those relationships.
The bar raiser is the worst fear of people in established relationships, because it shows us what's possible. It shows us that we don't have to live with compromises we once thought were unavoidable. When your partner lands in a relationship that's a whole new level of awesome, it can be difficult not to internalize feelings of shame, inadequacy, or failure. But doing that can make the problem worse, because when we feel ashamed or inadequate, we're more likely to lash out or be controlling. Feelings of inadequacy create a climate hostile to compassion and understanding. This is one of those times when compassion begins at home. None of us are perfect. Nobody is so good at relationships that we have nothing new to learn. Good relationships are a journey, not a destination. If someone shows us better ways to do things, that's okay. In fact, it's better than okay. It's marvelous. It can truly make our lives better. Bar-raising relationships aren't exclusive to polyamory. When a person in a monogamous relationship meets someone who raises the bar, the results tend to be catastrophic. People in monogamous relationships are sometimes so fearful of bar raisers that they don't permit their partners even to have opposite-sex friends. But preventing a poly partner from meeting someone who raises the bar is difficult or impossible. When bar raisers do happen, they alter the landscape. Scary as it is, we think that's a good thing. Ideally, something great happening to us spurs us to improve all of our existing relationships, revisiting the parts that don't work and building something better in their place. If you're in a relationship and meet someone who raises the bar for you, be graceful and compassionate. Don't compare your partners to each other. Why can't you be more like Jordan? It's corrosive to a relationship. Don't rank, don't blame. Instead, say, we had negotiated this particular arrangement, and it doesn't work for me now. Let's renegotiate. Let's build something stronger. Here are my ideas about how we can do this. If your partner starts a relationship with someone who raises the bar, you are challenged to rise above your limitations and move with courage toward the best version of yourself. A relationship that raises the bar can, sometimes, be a blessing in disguise. It can show you how to make all your relationships that much better. But not always. Sometimes, a new relationship reveals flaws in an existing relationship that can't be fixed. When that happens, there may be no easy way to handle it. The flawed relationship may end. Abuse. Some relationships are actively destructive to the people in them, emotionally or physically. Contrary to stereotype, an abusive relationship is often complicated and not always obvious, especially to those inside it. When we think of problematic poly relationships, we tend to focus on the fear that a new partner will be destructive, but often it's an existing partner that's the problem. After all, longer-lasting relationships have had more time for dysfunctional or toxic patterns to emerge and solidify. When you're partnered with someone who's in a harmful relationship with someone else, it can be difficult to know what to do. Both of us have found ourselves connected through a partner to an abusive relationship. In Franklin's case, one of his partners started a new relationship that turned abusive. In Eve's case, she became involved with someone who was already in an abusive relationship. In both cases, we felt helpless to protect our partners or intervene in the abusive dynamic. Abuse often develops slowly, insidiously. It's dangerous to pin your hopes on your partner waking up one day and seeing how bad the situation is. It's more dangerous still to rely on your partner leaving the abusive relationship. Abuse is usually much more obvious to people outside the relationship than to those who are in it. And people who do know they are in an abusive situation often feel powerless to leave. If you know or suspect that a partner is in an abusive situation, you may find there is little you can do directly, other than tell him your observations, express your concerns, and let him know you're there to support him if and when he decides to try and leave. You cannot rescue your partner, and it can be dangerous to your own mental health to try. In the end, only your partner can rescue himself. Abuse hotlines can offer you more detailed advice. They get many calls from concerned friends and family. Being in an intimate relationship with someone who is suffering abuse, especially if you fear for their physical safety, can cause you trauma. It's important to set good boundaries for yourself, care for yourself, and avoid getting drawn into the abuse dynamic, either as a victim or as a rescuer. Consider talking to a qualified mental health practitioner, not to help you figure out how to save your partner, but for your own sake. In some cases, you may need to protect yourself by limiting your involvement in the relationship or withdrawing from it entirely. One area where the waters can become very muddy is in hierarchical relationships. We talked more about these relationships in Chapter 11. It can be extremely difficult to tease out the warning signs of abuse in hierarchies because hierarchical relationships can mimic some of the structures of abusive monogamous relationships. Many primers on abusive relationships list cuts a person off from other sources of support as a prime warning sign. Other classic markers include someone making decisions for a partner and expecting her to obey without question, requiring her to check in frequently and report what she is doing, sharing her private information without consent, dismissing or disregarding her feelings, or restricting her access to other people in general. These are ways an abuser creates control, helplessness, and isolation. Each of these red flags sometimes exists in hierarchical poly relationships. In polyamory, limiting a partner's sources of support can play out through restrictions on other relationships, especially rules that prevent a partner from seeing others unless the primary partner is present. Someone who tries to limit a partner's contact with others is not necessarily abusive, but this sure makes abuse easier. One common element of many hierarchical relationships is that secondary partners are not expected or permitted to provide certain kinds of support to the primary partners. For instance, if a person is sick, there may be a rule that only the person's primary partner is allowed to be a caregiver. Secondary partners are not. Other hierarchical relationships may place restrictions on the type of emotional support a secondary partner is permitted to offer or ask of a primary partner. Such restrictions, too, are signs of an unhealthy dynamic. Many hierarchical structures require that a partner have sex with both members of a couple in order to continue in a relationship with one of them. We believe that requiring someone to have sex with you and threatening to withhold access to support, such as an intimate relationship with another, if sex is refused, is always coercive and always abusive. Relationship implosions. At some point, you are likely to find yourself involved with someone who has another relationship that's falling apart. This can put you in an extraordinarily difficult position. When your partner's other relationship is disintegrating, you have the difficult balancing act of being supportive without being sucked into the blast radius. It's easy to get emotionally involved when you see your partner hurting. That makes it easy to take sides, seeing the third party only through the lens of your partner's pain. At the same time, you may also become an easy scapegoat for the other relationship's problems. There's no easy path through this swamp, at least not that we've found. As hard as it is to see someone you love in pain, often you can do little other than be a shoulder to cry on and a place of refuge if needed. This is one of the downsides to polyamory. The odds are good that sooner or later someone else will hurt somebody you love, and there's not a lot you can do about it. One bit of advice we can give is do not underestimate how people will hold on to hope for a relationship long after it seems obvious to others that it's over. No matter how much a relationship is hurting your partner, don't assume that eventually he will see this and let go. Don't assume that if your partner is talking about ending it, he actually will. Human hearts have a phenomenal ability to hang on. Sometimes this serves us, but sometimes it doesn't. We often cling to things long after they've stopped bringing us joy. So for your part, if your partner's harmful or imploding relationship is hurting you, don't hang on yourself in the hope that your partner will end it. Until it's over, and sometimes until long after, you're better off assuming that it will continue. Even if your partner says it won't. We've seen people go back to unhealthy relationships far too many times, even after leaving or promising to leave. If you know you cannot be in a relationship with your partner if he stays in his damaging relationship, then the best decision might be to leave now, before you, too, become too invested or damaged by the situation to be able to leave. Often you find that in your partner's story and the story they spread to their social circle, you are cast as the villain, particularly if you are relatively new. When a relationship is in crisis, it's easy to blame an outsider. Again, there's no easy way through this, but we can give you this important truth to help you get through it. It's not you. Even if you're advocating for your needs and that's upsetting your metamour, even if part of the strife in the other relationship is jealousy or fear related to you, it's not you. As long as you act with integrity and recognize your partner's rights to make choices without controlling or manipulating him, you are not responsible for your partner's relationship with his other partners. You are not to blame simply because you added value to another person's life. Mental health issues and polyamory. Mental health issues complicate all relationships. When you add things like anxiety disorders, depression, or bipolar disorder to the mix, Polyrelationship challenges become a lot harder, and in some cases, intractable. A person with a serious psychiatric disorder may also lack the emotional, and in some cases, the financial means to support himself, which can cause him or his partner to feel trapped. Fully disclosing your known mental health issues is an important part of ethical relationships, because withholding information from anyone about things that affect them erodes informed consent. If you have a mental health issue that is likely to affect those close to you, or if you're partner with someone whose mental health issues affect your ability to interact with others, for example, if you're a caretaker for someone, or if a partner has a history of violence against herself or others, you are ethically obligated to disclose this information. Unfortunately, the stigma attached to mental health problems can discourage full disclosure. It's our responsibility to treat these disclosures with understanding and compassion, and to make it safe for our partners or potential partners to talk to us. If you're partnered with someone who has a mental health issue, it can become difficult to treat new people ethically and responsibly. New relationships can be especially triggering to people with some kinds of psychiatric disorders. For example, bipolar disorder is associated with higher rates of divorce and increased substance abuse, and high rates of anxiety can make coping with jealousy or a partner's absences much more challenging. People who have suffered abuse or abandonment may experience uncontrolled anxiety or fear of loss when their partners become involved with other people. This is particularly true if the mental health issues are untreated. If you're involved with someone who has a partner with mental health issues, and a dysfunctional dynamic exists between your partner and her partner, it can sometimes be difficult to keep yourself from being drawn into that dynamic. It's important to keep a clear distinction between being a partner and being a therapist. Few people are qualified to act as therapists. Even if we're trained for it, therapy usually requires emotional distance, the exact opposite of what we need to nurture romantic relationships. If you have a mental health issue that affects your ability to engage in ethical relationship, it's also important to take whatever steps you can to mitigate these effects. This might mean therapy, treatment, and making sure you get enough exercise and sleep. One problem that can arise with some mental health issues is unwillingness to seek treatment, because the issue has become a way to avoid dealing with other problems in a relationship. For example, if you're afraid of your partner spending time with another partner, and you know you can use your mental health issue to require your partner's attention, it can be easy to fall into a pattern where you find you need your partner's support whenever she is about to go on a date. Similarly, the standard poly advice to only add new partners that enhance existing relationships can, in practice, end up being used to tiptoe around mental health issues. If this policy results in only adding new partners who are okay with a dysfunctional relationship dynamic, or who help enable a person with mental health issues to avoid treatment, we would argue that the policy is not helping anyone. There are no hard and fast guidelines for relationships involving mental health problems, though setting and communicating clear boundaries is a vital tool. The best advice we can offer is to make choices about what level of involvement is or isn't appropriate for you, and set your boundaries accordingly. Questions to ask yourself. Not all problems have solutions. When trouble comes up that defy answers, you may find no path out that doesn't involve pain. When that happens, the best you can do is try and reach for the best, kindest, most courageous version of yourself. These questions may help when you're faced with the inevitable poly puzzles. Do the choices I make take me closer to, or further from, the best version of me? When I am faced with conflict, how do I seek to act with courage? Are there things I absolutely require in a relationship, and do I communicate those things? In what ways do I care for myself? How do I care for the people around me? Can I respond to changes in my relationship with grace? Do I have problems that make it difficult for my partners to be with me? How do I seek to mitigate those? Do I let problems in the relationship around me affect me? How do I assert boundaries around problems that aren't mine? 22. Relationship transitions. Have enough courage to trust one more time, and always one more time. Maya Angelou. People are living, dynamic organisms. You grow or you die. Actually, you die, period. Growth is optional. You will change. Your partner will change. Your relationship will change. This is a fact, something we must accept gracefully. If you fear change, if you cling too tightly to what your relationship is now and insist that this is the way it must always be, you risk breaking it. Yes, sometimes relationships change in ways that we do not want, and people grow in ways that take them apart rather than bring them together. That's the risk you accept when you get involved in this messy, complicated business of romantic relationships. The things you value in your relationship now may not exist in the future. The things you want now, you may not want in the future. The things you see in your partner now may not be there in the future. And that's okay. Adopt a fluid idea about the way your life will look. Keep in touch with your changing needs and those of your partners. Talk to your partners about these things openly and without fear. And you can build relationships that grow as you grow. If you do not, your relationships can become brittle and shatter. For example, when your partner starts a new relationship, you will probably have less of her time and attention. Even in the most inclusive group relationships, this can happen. Any relationship is likely to need alone time, no matter how much overlap there is. You're still likely to lose some time and attention. Is that something you can accept? Is your relationship resilient enough? Do you have things in your life other than your partners that enrich it and bring you joy? Or is all of your joy dependent on your partner's attention? Allowing change with grace, without expecting to control how the change happens, is a key skill we have seen in people who create strong, resilient, poly relationships. Be clear on what your relationship needs are. Be willing to advocate for them and accept that things are going to change. That way, you'll be ready. Re-evaluating relationships. In long-term relationships, usually a time arrives when the two new people you've become over the years stand there looking at each other and ask, whatever we believed or wanted a few years ago, do the people we are now belong in a relationship? Sometimes the answer is yes. These two new people will still want to be together, and then you move forward, perhaps stronger than before. But sometimes the answer is no. It doesn't make sense anymore. This is normal and okay. And yet somehow we always seem blindsided by this realization. We become angry and we treat a breakup almost universally in our society as though it shouldn't happen. In fact, people see this realization as betrayal. Think of the accusation, I don't even know you anymore. We act as though the ones we love should not be allowed to grow and change, or if they do, it means they love us less. Since people change all the time, we can debate whether it even makes sense to make lifelong commitments, at least in the way society encourages to. We're taught that marriage should mean our relationship never changes, rather than meaning we can be family for life, but the shape the family takes can change. Instead of the idea of breaking up, where the presumption is that you'll stay in a relationship until something makes you leave it, perhaps we should sit down every year, or few, and say, okay, who are we now? How is this relationship working? Do we like the way it's going? Should we change something? Do we even still like each other that much? Does it make sense to continue? If we think of this as renewing the relationship every now and again, and even if the answer to the last question is no, the result does not necessarily have to be a breaking. To use the widespread poly term, it's a transition. Expectations are brittle things. Not only do people change, but every relationship has a natural ebb and flow. Relationships can come and go, and come again with the same person. When we acknowledge that and allow space for changes to happen, we create relationships that can weather almost any storm. The best way to evaluate whether a relationship is a good one, regardless of what form it takes, is to think about the things you need and want in the relationship, and evaluate whether it gives you those things. It's not the shape of the relationship that's important, it's whether it meets your needs. Another good technique is to interrogate your feelings. When you think about the relationship ending, what is your first response? If it's a sense of relief, maybe it's time for the relationship to end. Of course, part of the fairy tale that's deeply ingrained in most of us is the idea that relationships only succeed if they last until someone dies. This is, if you think about it, a strange metric for success. If we manage to find one another's company pleasant enough for long enough, someone dies, and then we can claim success. Relationships are often measured in terms of longevity. If they end prior to death of one of the people, we call them failures. In his book, The Commitment, Love, Sex, Marriage, and My Family, columnist Dan Savage described his grandmother's unhappy marriage, which ended in her suicide. He commented, "The instant my grandmother died, her marriage became a success. Death parted my grandparents, not divorce, and death is the sole measure of a successful marriage. When a marriage ends in divorce, we say that it's failed. The marriage was a failure. Why? Because both parties got out alive? It doesn't matter if the parting is amicable. It doesn't matter if the exes are happier apart. It doesn't matter if two happy marriages take the place of one unhappy marriage. A marriage that ends in divorce failed. Only a marriage that ends with someone in the cooler down at Maloney's is a success." Longevity is a seductive idea because it can feel like even a joyless, loveless partnership is preferable to being alone. The two of us do not believe that just any relationship, no matter how unhappy, is preferable to no relationship. Rather, one of the core beliefs that underlies this book is the idea that only relationships that enrich our lives are worth striving for. Think about all the measures we use to tell whether or not a relationship is successful. How long it lasts, how often they have sex, how many children and grandchildren they have, perhaps how much money they make. It seems like whenever we try to figure out whether someone else's relationship is successful or not, it rarely occurs to us to ask the people involved if they believe it's successful. We have both had relationships end. Almost everyone does. Neither of us would call these relationships failures because they contributed to making us who we are today. We have taken things from those relationships, joy, personal growth, learning, love, laughter, that have enriched our lives. We are better for having had them. We propose a different metric for the success of a relationship. Relationships that make us the best versions of ourselves are successes. Those that don't are not, regardless of how long they last. A 10-year happy relationship that ends in friendship is more successful than a lifetime relationship of misery. That doesn't mean we think good relationships are always happy 100% of the time, or that we should bail at the first conflict or trouble. All relationships have their ups and downs. It is not reasonable to expect otherwise. On the whole, good relationships promote the long-term happiness and well-being of the people involved. When that no longer becomes possible, and there's no clear path to making it possible, then it might be time for the relationship to end. Relationships end. A fundamental premise of ethical relationships is that all relationships are consensual. That means people are free to enter relationships without coercion and free to end relationships that are not meeting their needs. An ethical relationship is one where nobody feels compelled to stay against their will. Coercion can be subtle. Most of us would say, "I would never coerce someone to stay with me against their will." But not all forms of coercion involve fists. Coercion takes a thousand forms. One particularly insidious form is the idea that everyone in a poly relationship should be on great terms with, or even be romantic or sexual partners with, everyone else in the relationship. This is an idea that's often given wonderful sounding names like family or inclusion. But there's an ethical trap built into the foundation. Say, for example, you have a full triad, a relationship with three people who are all sexually and romantically involved with one another. What happens if one of those relationships starts to crumble, or if one of the people no longer wishes to be involved with one of the others? Often, an implicit or even explicit understanding exists if that happens. The other relationship will end too. Charisse's story. Charisse started her exploration of polyamory when she was invited to join a relationship with a married couple, Pam and David. They were new to polyamory themselves, and after many discussions had decided they wanted to find a single, bisexual woman who would agree to be with both of them in an exclusive relationship. This, they reasoned, would be a good way to avoid problems with jealousy and to explore the world of polyamory without going too far outside their comfort zone. The relationship went well for about 6 months. After that, things between Charisse and Pam continued to grow, but the relationship between Charisse and David became strained. Eventually, Charisse decided she no longer wanted to be sexually intimate with David. When that happened, Pam and David became very upset. This wasn't the way they envisioned things. The idea that one of them might date someone the other one was not involved with seemed very threatening. So Pam gave Charisse an ultimatum. If you end your relationship with David, I will break up with you. Since Charisse was exclusive to them, this meant losing not one, but both of her relationships, with all the heartbreak that went along with it. She reluctantly remained sexually involved with both of them for another few months, even though she really didn't want to be intimate with David. The discomfort of this unwanted sexual attention seemed smaller than the pain of being dumped by Pam. Eventually, the relationship deteriorated to the point where she could no longer stay. Things ended as badly as you might expect. When they did, David and Pam blamed Charisse for the failure. After all, if she had only stuck to the original agreement, nothing bad would have happened. Attempts to engineer an outcome are almost always thickly sown with the seeds of coercion. If there is only one form a relationship can take, the foundation is laid. Play your assigned role or lose my affection. Any situation which dictates in advance how the relationship will develop disempowers the people in it. And disempowerment tends to turn coercive. Expectations of sexual or emotional intimacy with one person as a price for intimacy with another are an example of this kind of coercion, but it can take other forms. If there is an expectation, for example, that metamors must get along, that implies that if they can't, one or more relationships will end. And there doesn't even need to be any sort of threat for a relationship to be coercive. Sometimes internal feelings of guilt are sufficient. If you go into a relationship knowing the terms of engagement, and then those terms become hard for you to accept, it's easy to blame yourself. I knew what I was getting myself into. I agreed to this. I have nobody to blame but myself. I am being a homewrecker by not being able to make this work. Maybe I just need to force myself to be okay with how things are. I went into this with my eyes open, right? It has to be okay to end relationships. It has to be okay to end relationships without feeling that our support will be kicked out from under us, or that our other lovers will withdraw their love from us. When it's not okay to end a relationship, consent has left the building. Poly breakups. There's a saying among many poly people, relationships don't end, they just change. It's a noble idea, and one that society in general could probably benefit from. In monogamous relationships, it's quite common to see ex-partners as potential threats, and many people don't want to maintain friendships with exes, or more to the point, don't want their partners to maintain friendships with exes. In the poly community, where it's harder to avoid socializing with former partners, there's a greater emphasis on amicable breakups that preserve friendly or at least civil interactions. But relationships do end, even when friendship continues. The end of a romantic relationship is hard. It's normal to feel hurt. It's also normal to mourn the loss of a partner and the loss of the shared goals and dreams. Psychologists say the five stages of grief, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance apply to grief over a lost relationship as much as they apply to terminal illness. It takes time to grieve the loss, even when we want to preserve a friendship on the other side. Ending relationships with dignity and grace means knowing the emotional storm is coming and being prepared to weather it. There's no easy way to deal with the pain experienced when relationships end, at least not that we've discovered. The good news is that the pain eventually ends. It's natural to project our current emotional state into the future, and when pain is our current emotional state, it can be hard to remember that we've ever felt anything else. But pain ends. One thing that can help, at least a little, is to think of it as something to get through, like a bad movie you wish you were over already, rather than a part of your identity. I sometimes feel pain. It's very different from, I'm a person who has been hurt. When you make pain a part of your identity, it's harder to move on from it without suspicion and bitterness. But good relationships require loving, as though you've never been hurt before. A guarded heart is a closed heart. Here's Eve's story.
When Peter told me he felt that a breakup with Cleo was coming, I didn't respond the way I'd expected to. I had seen for a long time that they had been slipping away from each other. But even so, I found myself crying. What had once felt like a little family was splitting up, and the situation was entirely outside my control. It took a few months for their relationship to complete, and I struggled during that time with the lack of clarity. Cleo and I had forged a friendship independent of her relationship with Peter. Nevertheless, I knew that our relationship would change once she was no longer my metamour. I just wasn't sure how. I felt it wasn't fair to try to hasten a decision just to make the situation easier for me. It wasn't my relationship, after all. Their relationship officially ended close to what would have been their 4th anniversary. I was traveling when they finally had the conversation. Peter sent me a message when it was over. Again surprising myself, I cried most of the night, looking at old Facebook photos of the two of them and the three of us together. I laughed at myself. I was acting like I was the one who had just lost a relationship. In a sense, I had. Even though it wasn't mine, Peter and Cleo's relationship was an important part of my life. He had grown and changed from it, and so had I.
Poly breakups are both easier and harder than monogamous breakups. They're easier in the sense that when you have more than one partner, you may have more support to help you through the loss. It's nice to have people who can understand and empathize with your pain. However, this doesn't actually make the pain go away, though, believe it or not, we've both been asked, if you have two girlfriends and you lose one, it's still okay, because you still have a girlfriend, right? Which is a bit like saying, if you have two children and one dies, it's still okay because you still have one child, right? No matter how many relationships you have, breakups still cause pain. Poly breakups pose special challenges because the breakups can involve more people and can create ripples of ambiguity and uncertainty throughout all your relationships. Your partner's breakups may also affect you very seriously, even if you're not dating the same person your partner is. When two people share a partner in common and one of those relationships ends, the pain is greatly magnified.